Today at Reader's Corner, Peter S. Goodman, author of Davos Man, How the Billionaires Devoured the World. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. The history of the last half century in America, Europe, and other major economies is in large part the story of wealth flowing upward. The most affluent people emerged from capitalism's triumph in the Cold War to loot the peace, deprive governments of the resources needed to serve their people, and then leave them tragically unprepared for the worst pandemic in a century. In his latest book, Davos Man, How the Billionaires Devoured the World, journalist Peter S. Goodman profiles five representative members of the billionaire class, chronicling how their shocking exploitation of the global pandemic has hastened a 50-year trend of wealth centralization. Peter S. Goodman is the global economics correspondent for the New York Times, an award-winning journalist. He's extensively covered the internet bubble and the Great Recession, and is the author of Past Due, The End of Easy Money and the Renewal of the American Economy. Peter Goodman, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Peter, for our listeners who may not be that familiar with Davos, its formal name, World Economic Forum, why don't you share with us what it is and your experience there? I think you were a white badge guy.
Yeah, that's true. So the World Economic Forum is this annual gathering of the most powerful people on the planet in a little village, an otherwise unremarkable village in the Alps in Switzerland. And every January, typically, although it's a pandemic, which has screwed up the schedule, every January they meet billionaires, heads of state, public intellectuals, the odd celebrity, a whole bunch of journalists, and they get together under this mantra, committed to improving the state of the world, which is, you know, really ironic given that by any measure, these are the ultimate beneficiaries of the status quo. And they dive into what is publicly this, you know, earnest slate of panel discussions on all the sorts of things that you might expect: climate change, the future of work, gender and racial injustice. And in reality, the people actually matter. The people who pay the bills, the billionaire class, we're talking hedge funders, heads of financial and technology firms around the world, they will often not even set foot inside the conference center where all these meetings are happening. I mean, except for token appearances. Like I have literally seen billionaires engage in simulations of the Syrian refugee experience where they submit to being blindfolded and led around in the dark while someone's screaming at them in Arabic, demanding papers. And then they pat each other on the back and they go off to a banquet sponsored by some global bank or consulting firm. And they eat truffles and wash them down with champagne and do their next deals. So there are multiple levels to Davos. It's publicly this very earnest gathering. It's privately a place where the most powerful people on earth can meet, often in secret, unbothered by journalists in little conference rooms, yeah. Unbothered by regulators to do what they do, which is ultimately maintain the status quo.
Right. And they reaffirm what you call the cosmic lie. What's that?
Well, the cosmic lie is this idea that has gained guiding force, not by accident, over the last half century in many, many major economies, and especially in the U.S., that if we organize our societies around returning wealth to the people who already have most of it, we'll all somehow win. We'll have trickle-down economics. We'll have innovation. We'll have more freedom that way. We will all benefit from the wealthiest people getting more wealth because, you know, they're the good guys. And given that they're the good guys, the more wealth they have, the more freedom they have from things like regulation and progressive taxation, the more good they can do, even though in reality, the benefits of this idea have actually been achieved zero times. And you know, Davos is really key because it's a place where the billionaire class can virtue signal simply by being there and taking part, making all kinds of elaborate pledges about climate change and treating workers better. And they vow to tackle things like economic inequality and to address racial and gender imbalances. And, you know, basically nothing really happens. Then they go back to their homes, where they double down on what they really do, which is lobby for new tax loopholes, lobby for more deregulation. But Davos and other places like it, it's not that Davos is the center of some sort of puppeteer conspiracy. It's just a particularly good place to see the billionaire class in action. It's a place where they say to us, hey, we've got this. You don't have to regulate us. You don't have to stick us with antitrust enforcement and progressive taxation. If you just let us do what we do, we will handle all of life's problems.
So you chose five of these Davos men. That must have been a tough call getting it down to five. But I might also ask you, I would assume you, these guys know you, at least some of them. You're in New York City. You're the global economics correspondent. These guys are responsible for their firms all over the world. They must have seen you coming to some extent anyway.
I mean, I was very transparent about what I was doing.
Sure.
Nobody got ambushed by this book. Everybody had ample opportunity to engage. Yeah, I do know them to more and less degrees, you know, depending upon the individual. I mean, yeah. Mark Benioff, who's the CEO of Salesforce and in some ways the most interesting character in the book, engaged the most. He's somebody I've seen the most in terms of encounters at various trips to the World Economic Forum. I've never met Jeff Bezos, who's a major character in the book, and I didn't get any access to him, but he's a character, I think, for fairly obvious reasons. He's just so incredibly important. At different points during the time I was researching the book, he was the world's richest person. The others, I shouldn't get into sourcing, but I've certainly spent some time with most of the others in the book. And they were, you know, fully cognizant of my thesis, but they're so powerful and their interests are so vast that they mostly chose not to engage, and they've mostly ignored the book because when you start off winning to the degree to which they have, you tend to just get on with it and assume that your lobbyists and your accountants and your lawyers and your public relations apparatus can handle whatever problems, you know, a journalist may bring to your door.
Yeah. So you mentioned Benioff from Salesforce, and of course, you mentioned Bezos, but then there's three others that you...
Yeah, so there's Steve Schwarzman, who's the founder of Blackstone, which is the world's largest private equity company and a major holder of real estate around the world. He was, by the way, Donald Trump's primary financial backer in his reelection campaign, doubled down on his support for Trump, you know, right up until the January 6th. Insurrection and used that access to Trump to get a lot of very helpful deregulation, including opening up individual retirement accounts to things like private equity. Even though the academic literature shows that private equity is full of lots of promises that don't really pan out. If you're investing in private equity, there's a good chance you get lesser returns than you get simply from putting your money in a plain vanilla index fund, and you get stuck with lots of fees, but people keep falling for it. And companies like Blackstone are very good at public relations. Blackstone also was a primary investor into American healthcare in the run-up to the pandemic. And I tell the story of Ming Lin, who was an emergency room physician at a hospital in Bellingham, Washington, who was working for this company called Team Health, which is one of the two largest emergency room staffing companies owned by Blackstone. Blackstone bought it for about $6 billion several years ago. And, you know, it's no accident that Blackstone, run by this very savvy billionaire Steve Schwarzman, found itself investing in emergency rooms because, you know, in the same way that a casino magnate can tell you it's a good thing to make your money in a dark room where people don't know what time it is and they're drinking. If you're going to invest in healthcare, good to be in the place where the customer comes in on a gurney and isn't all that inclined to start asking you about the particularities of their health insurance policies. They're going to sign on the dotted line on the clipboard so they can go see the people in the white coats. Well, Team Health has been at the center of this surprise billing scandal you guys may have heard about. The surprise is not of the happy variety. It's when you show up at your hospital expecting that you're in your health insurance network, and then you discover weeks or months later that, no, actually, you signed off on the right for them to give you someone out of network and to bill you extravagantly, something you find out when collection agents start calling after you can't pay these incredible bills they send. Blackstone has done a lot of lobbying to preserve this. This was in the run-up to the pandemic. So Ming Lin, this emergency room doctor employed by Team Health, discovers in the first weeks of the pandemic that there are all these elective surgeries still going on in his hospital. There's nobody wearing a mask at reception. When he asks, you know, how come, he's told, well, we don't want to spook the customers. And by the way, elective surgeries, that's our bread and butter. But why is there no triage system? Same thing. We don't want to spook the customer. He complains to Blackstone and they say, listen, the hospital is our client. We want to keep them happy. So he takes his whistleblower case public. He goes on Facebook and says, I'm really worried here that we're exposing not just people in this hospital, but people around across the United States to the perils of what turns out to be the worst pandemic in a century. He's fired, underscoring that the profits of private equity magnates like Steve Schwarzman count for a whole lot more than public health. I also tell the story of Larry Fink, who is the world's largest asset manager. This is a company, he's the founder of BlackRock, which was an offshoot that he launched when he was briefly in partnership with Schwarzman's Blackstone. BlackRock manages roughly $10 trillion in assets. Yeah, you heard that right. That's trillion.
Wow. Yeah.
That's, you know, university endowments, pension funds from around the world. And Fink is a guy like Benioff, who's championed publicly this idea of stakeholder capitalism, this concept that companies are no longer just organized to return profit to shareholders, a la Milton Friedman. Now they're catering to stakeholders like labor, never labor unions, but labor, local governments, society. Benioff once famously said, not so famously, but I have it in my book, well, you know, the planet is a stakeholder, which is very reassuring to those of us who live on the planet. And in the book, I detail that these claims of stakeholder capitalism just don't pan out when you look at what these companies were up to during the pandemic. Fink personally turns the screws to the government of Argentina while they're cutting healthcare, while they're dealing with soaring poverty during the worst of the pandemic. He turns the screws to them so they can pay up on the debt that he owes to his own company.
I'm Bob Custer, host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with Peter S. Goodman, author of Davos Man, How the Billionaires Devoured the World. The book is a must-read for anyone concerned about economic justice and the sanctity of representative government. You have a number of people in this book. I'd call them the little men. The little men and little women, men and women who are basically wage earners, average wage earners, sometimes not even average wage earners, and they tell your story for you. And Dr. Lin is one good example of that. But another is Sonia Batista of the Marriott Corporation. I mean, we all wondered during this horrible pandemic. How can so many people survive being laid off of the measly incomes they were making? And you might share with our listeners just what kind of shape Marriott was in and is in today as they decided to take after the most vulnerable of their employees and lay them off.
Yeah, I appreciate your focusing on that story because I think it's a really important one. So, you know, let's just return for a second to this concept of stakeholder capitalism, which I argue in the book is just all about the billionaire class trying to protect themselves from actual regulation. You know, we will take care of being nice to employees, looking after societal interests. And in the summer of 2019, there is this pledge signed by 181 CEOs convened by the Business Roundtable, which is this big lobby shop in Washington that's comprised of CEOs of major companies. One of the signatories is the Marriott Corporation. And the late, because he passed away early in the pandemic, CEO Arne Sorensen. When the pandemic happens, the Business Roundtable puts Arne Sorensen in charge of a COVID task force to ensure that stakeholder capitalism is really the rule for companies that are dealing with employees struck by this catastrophe. Well, Sorensen gets a lot of respect in the public relations world for this video he produces that he distributes via social media, where he says, you know, I've never seen anything like this before. Our hotel rooms are closed around the globe. And unfortunately, it's really painful, but I'm going to have to furlough 3/4 of our workforce in the United States, including this woman you're focusing on, Sonia Bautista, who works as a maid at a 5-star Marriott property in San Francisco. Her husband, these are, you know, immigrants from El Salvador who fled, you know, the ravages of the terrifying civil war in El Salvador in the 80s. They made lives for themselves in San Francisco. Her husband works in a cafeteria at another Marriott property. They're watching this video. And Sorensen says, you know, so yeah, we're furloughing you, but I feel your pain. I'm going to forego my own salary in solidarity. That's a memory serves. I think it's like $1.3 million. he doesn't say anything about the $8 million in stock-based compensation, which one can assume he collects. And then a few weeks later, Marriott pays out several $1 million in dividends to its shareholders. So the Bautistas are laid off. They have no idea what's going to happen to their health care in the middle of a pandemic or how long they're going to be out of work. And, you know, I think most of us understand, well, this is how capitalism works in America, whether we like it or not. That's the nature of the beast. But here's Sorensen and the Business Roundtable using their experiences as a prop to signal their own virtues while they're actually cynically paying out to the stakeholder who matters the most, and that's the shareholder. So the shareholder collects these dividends that would have been enough to keep Sonia Bautista and the tens of thousands of other maids who were thrown out of their jobs, employed for several months. I mean, they could have paid their wages. And I had this heartbreaking conversation with Sonia Bautista, who, you know, was really dedicated to her job. I mean, I think we tend to think of low-level service sector workers, those of us who are lucky enough to work in offices or, you know, work safely from home during the pandemic. So, you know, these are not the most pleasant jobs, and most people will be doing something else. You know, there's a lot of esprit de corps, no matter what people are doing. People get a lot of value out of their jobs,
right?
And most people are pretty dedicated. And Sonia Bautista says, you know, we take a lot of pride in making those hotel rooms nice for the guests. And we think that in the middle of this catastrophe, there might be something for us and our families. It really shook her confidence in the country in which she was living. And Sorensen, you know, again, this is the guy who's heading the COVID task force for the Business Roundtable, the organization that gives us the stakeholder capitalism pledge. He's not an outlier. That pledge is signed by Jeff Bezos, who deprives his workers in warehouses of basic protection during the first wave of the pandemic. It's signed by Albert Bourla, who's the CEO of Pfizer, a company that, you know, thank goodness they gave us these COVID vaccines that have cut the hospital rates and the death rates. But he sells those vaccines to the highest bidder around the world. And as a result of that, we are all subsidizing the monopoly profits of Pfizer and Moderna and BioNTech through the continuation of this pandemic, the threat to our livelihoods, the disruption of our children's education, fear and death. I mean, ultimately, stakeholder capitalism or not, Pfizer makes a bunch of hollow pledges to contribute vaccines through, you know, COVAX, this philanthropic outfit that utterly fails. And so the result is, if you live in a rich country where the government can pay Pfizer their monopoly rents on vaccines, you're lucky enough to get access to vaccines. And if you live in a place like Pakistan or Ghana, you could even be a frontline medical worker and not have any protection while you're treating COVID patients. That's what stakeholder capitalism has amounted to.
Right. Tell us about Christian Small, another pandemic example, a guy who works at Amazon and notices that there's very little protection from COVID on the job.
Yeah, I love your focus on these characters in the story. So Christian Smalls has become fairly famous because he subsequently organized the first union to represent workers at Amazon. Christian Smalls is working in a warehouse in Staten Island in New York City. And he notices that suddenly in March of 2020, all the managers are gone. And a lot of employees are coughing, they're sick, they have fever. He's watching reports of the pandemic in the break room on these televisions, and he starts asking managers, what's going on? Where is everybody? And he's told, oh, the managers are all offsite at meetings. Oh, some of them are on vacation. And he gets very suspicious. And then it occurs to him that a lot of his people are suffering COVID. And when he asks for further explanation, he's told, no, don't worry about it. There's no cases here. Everything's fine. Well, he pushes. He makes himself a pain. And eventually, he leads a walkout, and he's fired for violating quarantine, which is incredibly ironic because he's advocating for every one of his colleagues to be quarantined until they get a handle on how many cases there are. It turns out there actually are lots of cases in his warehouse. But he wants everyone sent home with paid sick leave, something that not by accident Amazon doesn't provide. They've been lobbying as a company against any kind of federal paid sick leave policy. So Christian Smalls is thrown out of work. He becomes a sort of public face of this emerging labor movement. And that's not by accident either. Christian Smalls is an African-American guy who grew up around Newark, New Jersey. He told me, you know, all of his bosses throughout his career had been these white guys in warehouses riding around in forklifts with bullhorns, yelling at largely African-American workforces to move faster. He said it was like, you know, working in the cotton fields. And then there's a meeting after he's fired, because this becomes a full-blown public relations disaster for Amazon, with this guy, Zapolsky, who's the general counsel, and Jeff Bezos himself. And thanks to Vice News, we know from notes about this meeting that were leaked to Vice News, that Zapolsky specifically says, well, let's make Christian Smalls the public face of this movement because he's not smart or articulate. And to the extent to which we can put the lens on him will benefit. Bezos apparently doesn't disagree with this because there's no notation to the contrary. Well, when I asked, and I should tell you, Zapolsky, if you go on his Facebook feed, as I did, you learn that he grew up in New Jersey also. He went to elite private schools, went to Ivy League universities. He's now the general counsel for this giant successful e-commerce company. He's got a picture of John Lewis, the late civil rights hero, on his Facebook profile. And when I push Amazon for explanation of how they can go after a guy like Christian Smalls with the not smart or articulate trope, they give me this milquetoast statement. Oh, Mr. Zapolsky was not aware of Mr. Smalls' race at the time he made those comments. Well, I'll let the reader parse the merits of that.
No kidding. You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Peter S. Goodman, author of Davos Man, How the Billionaires Devoured the World. So when we talk about these issues regarding wealth and income distribution, income inequality, we hear the old saw so often, well, it's the Republicans who are for business, it's the Democrats who are for unions. But the Davos men work both sides of the aisle, as comes up many times in your book, whether it's Clinton and the WTO and NAFTA, whether it's Obama, even Biden comes up, President Biden, right, when he was a senator. I wonder if you could just comment on the fact that this isn't just about one party that is propped up by these guys. This is really about governance in Washington, period, propped up by these guys.
Yeah, and worldwide. I mean, yeah. Davos Man, and Davos Man is a term that I'm borrowing from Samuel Huntington, who's the late political scientist who coined it in 2004 to refer to people whose wealth is so complicated that it straddles multiple jurisdictions. You know, these are people who own houses the way most of us own socks. They employ accountants and lawyers and lobbyists in multiple countries. I'm using it to refer to the billionaire class that would have us believe that, you know, their interests and our interests are the same. Well, right. Davos Man, as I lay out in the book, is very skilled at getting what he wants, regardless of who's in power. There's no ideology beyond the bottom line. And Davos Man is for free trade when that's in his interest. Davos Man is for protectionism when that's in his interest. The only constants are tax cuts and deregulation are good. And yeah, if you focus on the states, I mean, Bill Clinton and Barack Obama and George W. Bush and Ronald Reagan and the first Bush, you know, they all eliminated antitrust enforcement and allowed monopoly power to rise. Reagan began the tax cutting, but it's continued in various forms. You know, even Clinton, who's not really known as a tax cutter, opened enormous loopholes. You know, bought into the idea that businesses left to their own devices will produce innovation and economic growth, and bought into that not by accident. I mean, because Washington was just lousy with lobbyists selling that idea and holding fundraisers and sending campaign cash into both parties, Democrats and Republicans alike. Joe Biden comes into office, you know, vowing this return to normalcy after the Trump years, which, you know, we can talk about if you want. I mean, Trump, of course, you know, takes power as this wrecking ball pointed at the elites. And there's some of that in terms of, you know, sticking tariffs on Chinese goods. But really, you know, in the final analysis, I mean, Trump delivers the largest package of tax cuts ever, $1.5 trillion package of tax cuts, lavished mostly on people like Steve Schwarzman and other billionaires. And then Biden comes in vowing this return to normalcy. But normalcy for him is, you know, taking campaign contributions from finance, from pharma. And I think it's not coincidental that Biden's made some noise about forcing pharmaceutical companies to share their wares, to share their technology so that COVID vaccines can be made in the rest of the world, and has done basically nothing to back that up, while his tax increases have gone nowhere. And he has not embraced the wealth tax, except rhetorically. So Davos, man, consistently wins no matter who's running the government.
You close your book with the big truth that is revealed by exposing the cosmic lie over the last four decades. Tell us about that and the challenge of turning this all around, Peter. This is going to be tough because this is not like the old trust-busting days when Teddy took over.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the billionaires have social media now and the ability to insinuate their viewpoints into the discourse through all sorts of public relations platforms. I mean, Amazon actually makes these fake TV spots with interviews with happy workers saying everything's great and we're protected and we don't need a union. And they actually get scores of local TV stations around the country to run these as if they're just straight up news spots. So yeah, the powers of Davos, man, compared to the robber barons, really vast. On the other hand, you know, yeah, what I call the big truth is the realization that we don't need some sort of revolution. We don't need some kind of utopian fantasy to restore our basic democratic functioning. We need something that's been there all along, and that's democracy. We need basic, old-fashioned, progressive taxation, antitrust enforcement, rules that allow labor unions to collectively bargain so they can get a piece of the action. And this is not something that we have to dream about. This is something that we've already experienced. I mean, that was the American economy from the end of the Second World War to the late 1970s. Now, I don't want some time machine back to then. We've made an enormous amount of social progress. We had Jim Crow law in the 60s. We had the Vietnam War in the 60s and 70s. We don't need to go back in time, but we do need to reclaim something that's really important. And that's just an economic system in which people can set an alarm clock, go off to work, stay out of trouble, and know that that will be enough to allow them to support their families at a middle-class standard. And if we got back to progressive taxation and antitrust enforcement and collective bargaining, we could solve a lot of our problems. Now, that is easier said than done, because, you know, the whole point of my book is to show that Davos, man, has effectively monopolized the levers of our democratic governance. And none of the, you know, the tax cutting, the lifting of antitrust enforcements, the rules that weaken collective bargaining and labor power in general, the shifting of jobs to low-wage countries, you know, none of this has happened by accident. It has happened by insinuating these ideas And these kind of false binaries. I spent a lot of the book showing how Davos Man has convinced us that we can either have the status quo with all of its inequalities, but with tremendous conveniences like Uber, the miracles of modern healthcare, central air conditioning, travel, you know, all the stuff that we favor. We can either have that or we can monkey with this magic formula, and then we might as well be Venezuela with people diving into dumpsters for their dinner. That's just false. And we need to get rid of these ideas, and it's going to require some mass mobilization to ultimately limit the power of Davos Man to affect not just our political system, but our thinking about how economies can function. You know, it's very easy for Davos Man to label anything that looks like just fair distribution of the wealth as, oh, that's socialism or communism, or, you know, you're going to monkey wrench our economy. We need to reclaim not only the levers of governance, but our basic ideas about the world that we're living in.
It seems like the great challenge here is finding the right messenger. I mean, there's no question that Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders were delivering a message similar to the one you're talking about here, but it didn't work for them. And here we are facing the midterms and then facing 2024. And you just wonder, is there anybody? I know you're the global economics correspondent, not the global political correspondent.
Right.
So you probably don't have any better answer than most of us do. But I think what's going to get this done is someone riding in on a white horse that is believable and that people can trust. And I don't know whether
we got there. I don't think it's about someone riding in on a white horse. Like, I mean, the whole reason for my writing this book is to try to convince people that, you know, in the same way that we shouldn't be looking to the billionaires to solve our problems, we don't need to demonize the billionaires either, right? I mean, I don't have any problem with businesses producing innovation, people getting rich based on their good ideas. I don't have a beef with Jeff Bezos being super wealthy. I mean, I have a beef with not paying taxes and undermining the workings of our democracy for his own benefit at the expense of society. We can live in a world where there is some inequality, where some people win tremendously, and where they have to pay their fair share in taxes. And that's not going to happen from some individual, you know, any more than we should fall for the billionaires will solve climate change. So, you know, go back to the couch and watch the football game. That's going to happen from people getting engaged in the mass movements that will be required to weaken the hold of the billionaire class on our political system. And, you know, if you look at, you know, what's Christian Smalls been up to in the last few months? Well, he's been organizing workers in Staten Island, and they now have a union. And that's a movement that could potentially spread to other places. You know, Christian Smalls didn't ride in on a white horse. He got a lot of people who were in the same situation that he faced to realize that their interests are collective, and that if they work together, they actually have more power than one might think standing up against the richest, most powerful corporation on earth. That's the kind of thing that will ultimately allow us to reclaim our democracies.
A fitting conclusion to a really fascinating conversation with Peter Goodman. The name of your book, Davos Man, How the Billionaires Devoured the World. Peter, thanks so much for joining us today. And as I said before we started this interview, I think your book is just one of the most important books we've ever had on Reader's Corner. And I'm delighted to have you on. Thanks for writing it and thanks for being here today.
Oh, I'm so grateful for your time and your interest. Thanks for your terrific questions.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.